Thank you so much for joining us for yet another episode of What Page Are You On? It is my great delight to introduce this special interview episode with a cool gal that I've followed on the internet for a long time and have never met until today. Would you like to introduce yourself?
My name is Louise O'Neill, and it is quite weird only meeting you today because sometimes with social media, it fosters this sense of intimacy where I feel like I know you incredibly well.
And then that's how a lot of people
realization,
feel.
It's like, oh, we've actually never met in real life. But you look exactly like your photos, which is always a pleasant...
Thank you.
You know, because sometimes you meet people and you're like, no.
Whom?
Yeah.
That is what my husband said when he met me off OkCupid. So I feel like if he said that and you say that, it must be true. So we are largely here to talk about the paperback publication of your book, The Surface Breaks. Would you like to tell our lovely listeners at home about The Surface Breaks?
Yeah, of course. The Surface Breaks is a feminist retelling of The Little Mermaid, which was one of my favourite fairy tales when I was a child. And I think it was only as a teenager when I suppose when I began to identify as a feminist, and you start to critique, I think, a lot of the culture in which you live, a lot of the culture that you're consuming, and wonder, I suppose, about the impact that, you know, it might have had on me. And I think when I started to look at The Little Mermaid with a more critical eye, and you think, okay, this is about a young woman who mutilates her body and literally gives up her voice. She silences herself so that a man that she has, like, seen once will find her acceptable enough to love her. It's so fucked up. And I think, I suppose it was having had an eating disorder as a teenager, and having, I suppose, inflicted that kind of harm upon my own body in order to, again, be acceptable enough for what I think society expected women to look like. I think I began to wonder about the sort of messages that I had internalised from that story. So when Lauren, who's an editor here at Scholastic, when she approached me and asked me if I'd be interested in doing a feminist reimagining of the story, I just jumped at the chance. It was sort of a dream opportunity.
And it's one of those things that I think it can have lingered in your mind for like 10 years, but it just takes someone saying like, have you ever thought about doing this? For you to be like, yeah, I want to do that. That's what I want to do.
Yeah, someone nearly to give you permission, I think, as well. And when she asked me to do it, I was really busy at the time and I probably should have said no, but I think there was a part of me that was like, I won't be able to read whoever, if she asked someone else to do this, I won't be able to read that version of it because I'll be so disappointed that I wasn't able to do it myself, because I think, you know, I had an idea for what I would want to do with the story, because like Lauren had said to me, you know, you have free scope here, you can do whatever you want with it, and I wanted to hew as closely to the original story as possible, but to, I suppose, really highlight how dark and problematic that story was, because I think if I had gone too far away from it, people would forget that the original story is actually incredibly messed up.
Yeah, and also has, like, I remember when I read that as a child, obviously having watched the Disney cartoon, and I read the story and I was like so shocked by the ending that I like had to reread it loads of times to be like, so she just disappears into foam, she's just dead, she's just nothing good happened.
Yeah.
Like, I was so like mind boggled, shocked as like a child or like teenager or whatever.
Yeah.
But like, it's really only the ending that highlights the darkness, whereas like this book throughout is very amplifies all the gnarliest, darkest parts of the story.
Mm.
Personally, as a little gremlin, I really enjoyed that. did you kind of just stick to the original fairy tale source material? What other?
Yeah, it was funny because when, you know, because obviously this was the Disney version that came out when I was four, and I mean, it was just such a, I think it was like a perfect storm in a lot of ways, because it was the first Disney princess that had come out in 30 years since, I think it was Snow White in 1959. And you're also talking like late 80s, you know, time of consumerism and materialism and branding. And so, and VHS, you know, so that you could have this in your home and watch it over and over again. So it was just this perfect, I think, moment in time for this story to imprint itself upon my subconscious in a way. So I knew that story really well, but I didn't go back to the Disney version because I think I wanted to stay with the original fairy tale. So I read that story over and over and over again. I listened to it on a podcast, like when I was running or when I was at the gym, so that it was, you know, it was constantly kind of playing in the back of my head. And then there were other things that I looked at as well, like because of the sisters in it, I was really interested. You know, there is five sisters in the story, and I wanted to give them all really distinct personalities. So the two books that came to mind for me was The Virgin Suicides and Jane Austen, Pride and Prejudice, and because, you know, of, I suppose, the relationship, the complexity of the relationship between sisters, the kind of competitiveness, comparison, which I think is sort of acts as a microcosm for sometimes how women act or are conditioned to act, kind of, I think, on a larger cultural scale. And then, which was something, I suppose, that we had talked about with the Sea Witch in this book, which we'll I'm sure get into later. I had approached you ages ago, like in the start of 2016, I
yeah,
think.
It yeah. was definitely like a long time ago.
A long time ago, because I had been, when I was writing Almost Love, I had it in my mind that I was going to, the main character was going to be fat. So I had approached a lot of fat women that I knew, and others, you know, that just, I had sort of put a call out on the internet, and had spoken to them, and I had done a lot of reading around it. And then I don't know, I think there was a part of me that just felt, I just didn't think it was maybe my story to tell. And I think I think it might have been you. I'm sorry, because I remember saying something once on Twitter, and you very politely but quite firmly sort of called me out and sort of put me in my place. And
I don't remember that at all. Like, no, yeah, it sounds exactly like me, but I do not remember doing that.
No, you were very nice about it, but I was like, and I think what it was that I had made the mistake, I think, of thinking because I had had an eating disorder and because I had felt fat, that I understood what it was to be fat.
Yeah.
And I think it was very much highlighted to me that know that those are completely distinct and different, and you can't. But I think we've seen a little bit with celebrity at the moment that if they've had anorexia or if they've had bulimia, that they have sort of really co-opted the body positivity movement. And I think that it's important to acknowledge that, you know, thin women are made to feel inadequate, but that's a completely different experience to living in the world in a fat body.
And like personal bad feelings is not the same as systemic oppression. And then, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. 100%. And I thought that was a really important kind of learning experience for me. And to say that, yes, there, I think there are, there is an empathy there, or you can, you know, you can maybe imagine, but I think it's totally different to having a full understanding of what that is like. So I think I was kind of shying away from that a little bit, but I still, I suppose, had all of this information. And then when it came to The Surface Breaks, and because I suppose the character of Ursula in the Disney version was still looming large in my mind's eye, that I thought this is a perfect opportunity, I suppose, to use some of this information and to inform this particular character.
And obviously, you know, just because it might not be a good idea to write a whole main character whose point of view you see the whole story through, who has experiences that you don't personally have, it doesn't mean that kind of different kinds of characters with different experiences and different bodies from different places should just be absent from your work.
Yeah, like, of course. That's,
yeah.
Absolutely.
And I feel like the Sea Witch character in The Surface Breaks just works so well because she's kind of the symbol of a liberated woman in lots of ways, and I think it's a very cool way of interpreting Ursula from the Disney cartoon.
Yeah, well, I've done a lot of, I suppose, back, like academic reading as well, and I'm trying to think of the, like, The Witch Must Die, and there was a Jack Zipes book and a Maria Tartar book, so there was a, you know, and I think what was quite interesting with a lot of that was the way they talked about how, I suppose, the character of the witch in the fairy tale, and how that tends to be, you know, either a woman who is older, you know, the way that, I suppose, that we treat women as they age is sort of like they're losing value, or they're using losing worth, and also I think this kind of marginalisation of women who refuse to conform, particularly, I suppose, to patriarchal religions in especially, you know, the Middle Ages or, you know, things like that, that they were also castigated and cast out of society as a witch. I thought it would be really interesting, particularly, so I suppose the character of Ursula is, as a kid, I remember there was a girl in my class whose name was Ursula, and we were all like, oh my god, you're a witch, you're a witch. And now it's like Ursula is the coolest character, she is the best Disney villain.
Yeah, it feels like she really, more than anyone in the whole Disney oeuvre, has been kind of reclaimed in the 21st century as actually like really fucking cool.
Yeah. Well, I suppose it's because there was all, you know, that she was based on a drag queen.
Yeah.
So I think that there was all this coding that people maybe are more able to recognise now and say, oh no, actually we are going to reclaim this character.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Because she is cool.
She is very cool.
So I feel like, I don't know, when I was reading it, I was also kind of reading it through the knowledge that you are an Irish lady, and how well it also works as a kind of colonialism metaphor of like the sea and above the sea, and they're just like mindlessly trying to take everything that the sea has and are very dangerous. And obviously, you know, with the sea as Ireland and the land as England.
Yeah.
Is that...
Oh, God, I was going to say we won't go into... This could get very political. No, I think...
No, obviously, I'm, 100% on board with it. I was reading it, and I was like, yes, this is true. Like, all of this works.
I mean, I actually really like that. I don't think that was something that I was consciously trying to do. It's funny, I used to read this novelist when I was a child called Eilish Dillon, and she used to write a lot of stories that were set on islands. And it was only as an adult that I realised that they were stories about, you know, that the island was Ireland, and when they talked about the mainland, that was the UK, and I didn't actually realise that it was an allegory for colonialism. I think I was trying to there's a commentary that was running through the book around the danger of othering people, and that I suppose is something that we are seeing so much in the States with Donald Trump, and here in the UK with Brexit, and you know, with the rise of sort of very right wing politics throughout Europe, and it's very unsettling. It's very unnerving to sort of, you know, to see that, because I think we're more alike than, which is such a, it sounds like such a cliche to say, but we are more alike than we are different. And I think this way that we try and make ourselves feel superior by trying to denigrate other people, and I think it's really dangerous, because once you start that, once you start to dehumanize people, like, you're on a very dangerous route there. And I suppose because of the fact that I've been watching this play out over the last couple of years, it has been something, I suppose, at the back of my mind, and something that I wanted to write about in the book. And being Irish, I suppose the stuff that maybe that was more prevalent from an Irish point of view was maybe more with the Rusalkas, which was really interesting. I'd come across it. It's in Slavic tradition, with women who were killed in very tragic circumstances. So maybe if they had died in childbirth, or if they had been jilted at the altar and had taken their own lives, that they would have come back as these creatures, the Rusalka. And I thought it was, particularly in Ireland, with you know, the mother and baby homes,
yeah,
and the Magdalene laundries, which for us, if people aren't aware, were these institutions that were set up by the Catholic Church, where unmarried women, or women who, I suppose, really dared to be sexual outside of marriage, were thrown into these. They were imprisoned here. Their children were taken off them and sold to the highest bidders in the UK and in the US, and their lives were absolutely destroyed. And I think it was just, I suppose, one element of the way in which the church really tried to control the female body and the female sexuality in Ireland. And I suppose a lot of the Rusalka that I had in the book had Irish names, you know, like Sive.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm very impressed that you pronounced that correctly, because I was like, oh, no one in the UK is good. Because Irish names are complicated. Some of them are quite complicated. So I'm very impressed that you
pronounced
that correctly.
This is actually the second podcast in which an Irish author has complimented my pronunciation of Sive. So thank you.
Of course, the Aisling books.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. But yeah, no, I thought that was a really cool, explicit way of... not just kind of theoretical feminism, but also bringing in like real world examples of things that have happened in the last, I don't know, 50 years or whatever, and I love that.
It's interesting because, you know, obviously, you know, when you talk about colonialism and post-colonialism, and, you know, obviously, Ireland, you know, it's 800 years of oppression, and I think that that goes very deep, and but I also think what's been really fascinating is that having got, you know, it was the idea of 800 years of oppression and, you know, Brits out and all this kind of idea, was that actually, like, Britain was there for so many Irish women. Like, Britain, you know, took Irish women in, you know, gave them discounts on their abortion when, you know, when they would hear an Irish accent on the other end of the phone would say, you know, do you need someone to pick you up at the airport or at the ferry or however you're coming. It's just interesting, I think, in some ways we were probably nearly better off. I mean, obviously, since the referendum, like, that's, you know, changed, but I think that in some ways Irish women before the rising and before independence, they were nearly treated better under British rule, because which was such a shame, because the proclamation, which was 1916, was this incredibly feminist, you know, it was all men, all Irish men and all Irish women will be equal, will have equal rights and opportunities. Like, that is in the literal of independence, and it just was such a shame, I think, that the Catholic Church sort of
weaseled in there,
sort of putting their weight upon it, and, you know, and women were erased from the narrative of the War of Independence. And I don't know how I've gotten into this, but anyway, I'm giving you a lot of history here.
No, it's very good. I'm very down with it. So how does this fit in with your novels in general? How do you feel your novels fit together? So this is for younger people.
Yes.
But the novel that you published just before that was for adults, mm-hmm. and that was your first for adults.
Yes. I mean, it's difficult because I think The Surface Breaks is probably, I'm trying to think, I don't really know if I believe in, I mean, obviously, yes, there are some books that are, you know, more for middle grade or for YA, but I think that with my books, they always seem to be like read by from 14 to 60, 70, you know, there was always quite a wide range of readership, I think, in all ages. So I suppose I just always told the story that I wanted to tell in the way that I felt it needed to be told. And it's funny, I suppose now looking back, you know, I've just finished the first draft of my fifth novel, and that's very different again. And there's a part of me that's like, I really just need to decide on a genre or decide on kind of a style, because I think that is easier with branding. And sometimes for the reader, particularly, I think people who don't read that often or that much, you know, they like to go into a bookshop and see a John Grisham or a...
They know what they like, and they want to find more.
And they're
more.
Like, that's perfect. I know what I'm going to get with this novel. I know when I'm going on my holiday or I'm going wherever, that I know that I'm not going to be disappointed. It's a bit like when you go away and you're like, oh, I don't have time to find a proper coffee shop, but I know that I can get a half decent coffee in Starbucks.
Yeah,
so that sort of idea.
I just want to find a Starbucks.
Yeah, you know,
I don't want to go into like a Parisian coffee shop where someone might be rude to me. Yeah. I just want to get what I want,
and it could be amazing, but it could also be terrible. And sometimes I think if you don't have enough time, sometimes it's kind of easy, those choices, if you can limit them in that way. But I suppose, and I remember having a meeting with an agent when I was first about to be signed, and they sort of explained it to me in that way. They were like, you know, we need to be able to market you, we need to be able to brand you, we need that an author or that a reader will come in and say, this is a Louise O'Neill novel, we know what that's like. And I think I knew instinctively that I would get really bored with that, because I have such a low boredom threshold, and I like to sort of be challenged, and I didn't, you know, the first novel was dystopian, and I just felt like, I really don't think I will be able to sustain a career where I write only ever yours. Yeah. Over and over and over and over again, and sort of different iterations of that. So, like, they have all been, like, the first one was dystopian, the second one was contemporary YA, the third one was contemporary adult, this one is fantasy. The next book has, I suppose, it's more of, not really thriller, but there's kind of that kind of element slightly to it. But so they're all so different, but I suppose the thread that, like, goes through all of them is feminism.
Yeah. You know, women and what happens to women.
Yeah, and issues that I think directly impact women, whether that's, I mean, the new book, I suppose there's a more domestic violence, and with, you know, it's body image, and it is sexuality, and it is, you know, power dynamics in relationships, and sexual violence and rape culture and victim, like, you know, it's kind of, I suppose that is the thread that kind of goes through all of them.
Because I feel like, rightly, on the back of this book, it does have a little sticker that says, like, not suitable for younger readers. Because this, it is quite gnarly and violent.
Yeah.
Like, physically, not necessarily, like, sexual violence, but, like, when she has, like, her tongue cut out, and the way that not having a tail impacts her kind of legs and feet, that's quite graphic. Yeah. I really liked that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, in the original fairy tale, it is also like she's in a tremendous amount of pain. I remember when my dad read it, he's the first one to read all of the books. This was his favourite. He was really obsessed with it. It was quite odd, but anyway. He kept asking me, could he borrow books on mermaid mythology for weeks afterwards? but he said to me, he was like, I really want to read the original again. He said, I can't remember. Was this in it? Did you make up this bit? And then he read it, and he came to me and he said, I'm so sorry, I can't believe we read this story to you. This is awful. Like, it's so violent.
Yeah.
So...
And it's really interesting the way that, like, it is the same story that became The Little Mermaid, the Disney film. And it almost makes you kind of ask, like, what is the purpose of those films? Like, what... If you've taken this source material that's so... kind of violent and dark, and then you've just turned it into like singing fish, like what is the purpose of it, and like what does that do,
the sanitization?
So
I don't know, for a broader, I don't know, maybe it's the things that maybe were thought as acceptable for children, now they want to protect. I think there's an element of constantly wanting to protect children, and I mean, I think that's really important up until the point where they become teenagers. And I've had people say, oh, you know, I'm not sure if I want my 16-year-old to read, let's say, asking for it. And I feel like that's where the point where the desire to protect children actually it's sort of, I think...
Kind of dangerous.
Yes, I agree, because you're not giving them the information, you're not giving them the tools...
To prepare themselves for how horrible the world is.
And they're in that world already. They're being exposed to things, you know, through porn probably at that age already.
Yeah.
It's like a book that is trying to, I think... help them navigate this world is a much better tool to allow, you know, to afford them than just letting them off, I think.
Thinking that the world is good and nothing ever hurts. Because I think that's something that I kind of think about a lot when I've been, like, writing fiction, especially for younger people, is, like, this weird combination of not wanting... I guess wanting to kind of give a useful message through fiction, like teach someone something useful that may help them in their lives. And then, but also being very conscious of, like, I am an old person now, and I don't just want to be, like, preaching through my books. But I don't know, I do think there is something really valuable about being able to look at your life and go, how would I have wanted it? If I could do this again, what would I have wanted to know? And how would I have wanted to make my life play out if I had better tools, better information?
Yeah.
And I think that's something very cool and powerful about being able to do that.
I agree. And I think with books, like, there is a power in that, because, you know, when I was reading your book, No Big Deal, I just thought, oh, wow, this is... I would have loved to have read something like this when I was a teenager. You know, I would have loved to have read... something with, you know, she, like Emily, no spoilers, but, like, you know, because it's coming out in August, but, you know, that Emily is fat and she wears the most amazing clothes and she's really cool and she's, you know, she's really into music, and you know, I just thought, yeah, that's so empowering, rather than, you know, someone who hates herself, or, you know, that she, like,
or that the only fat character that appears in a book is, like, gets bullied or, like, is not cool and has no friends, and it's like, that's just not true, like, that's not people's lives, and, like, in The Surface Breaks, the kind of key fat character is, like, the queen of all of the ladies.
She was very cool. But I also think that, like, because when I was not a teenager, it was a preteen, and I was reading a lot of like Sweet Valley High, and you know, it's funny because I obviously didn't really pay any attention to it, but it's when I went back sort of as an adult to look at it, the fat phobia in it is, it's not just, I suppose, that there's a fat character in it and they're bullied and that people are like, it's wrong. Like, the main two characters are constant, you know, like, there's this constant, like, oh, they've got the perfect size six figure, you know, blah, 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 whatever. And But the way that they think, because, you know, it's their point of view, and the way that they think when they look at fat characters is just so, like, they find it really repellent. And, like, that's the sort of messaging that I was absorbing. I was like, it would have been, like, to the point where it became this thing, well, it's like a real fear of, you know,
being seen through those eyes by other people.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's just the thing is, at that age, and I suppose at any age, really, is that all you want is to be loved and to be accepted.
And to feel like normal.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I think feeling normal is a very powerful feeling, and I think, yeah.
And I just thought if there had been a diversity of representation and of thought, that would have been really powerful. Like, it's just when I'm writing YA, a lot of the time I'm like, what would I have wanted to have read, and also what would have been helpful to have read, you know?
Yeah, I think I worry too much about being like an old person trying to teach young people things, and I should just like chill out,
yeah,
you know.
No. The book is great. You have nothing to worry about.
Well, thank you. So I always feel like, as well as talking about people's books, I always want to nerdishly, as someone who writes, know how other people write. So how do you write? What's your like?
I'm trying to think. They've all been quite different. It's funny how, like, with the most recent book that I wrote, my editor was going on maternity leave, so she wanted an outline before she left, and that was the first time that I'd ever written an outline. But I wrote the book so much quicker because I
had done the mental work.
I'm like, oh, just gotta see how this goes.
Yeah.
So that came much much quicker. And then, like, with Only Ever Yours, which was the first novel, I had no planning whatsoever. I just kind of sat down and sort of but I think a lot of people find the first novel that tends to be a little bit what it's like, because it's almost as if you've been writing it for your entire life. And then you sit down and you write it, and then
you have to literally put the words on the page.
Yeah, exactly. But I think when I write, like, I'll have this story idea, and then the characters is kind of where, before I start writing, I want them to feel like very real to me. So I'll do like little interviews with each of them. It's normally around sort of 5A4 pages, and it's like really. Some of it's so stupid, like, it's like, you know, well, obviously I like to know their physicality and how they talk, and do they have any sort of tics that they do when they talk, or, you know, how they walk, and what their hobbies are and what their favourite TV shows are, and then things like that the reader will never know, like, what's their greatest secret, what's their first memory, what's the thing they're most ashamed of, you know, what's the thing that they're most proud, you know, things like that again, you won't come up in the book. But I feel like when I know that, I have a real understanding of their, well, hopefully a better understanding of their motivation and of why they behave the way they do. And then that adds depth to the book. Do you know what I mean? So just kind of, you keep coming down and down and down and adding layers to make them feel like fully fleshed individuals. And that's, again, like, that's a process. Like, that's like first edit, second edit, third. Like, I keep trying to kind of dig in and go deeper and bring more layers and bring more complexity to the character. But with the first draft, I always overwrite. They always tend to kind of end up the first draft in 120, and then I bring them back. Like, I cut nearly half with Almost Love. That was 130, and the final book was 65,000. So, like, you know, I always
trim substantially.
Yeah, absolutely. Because my editor always says, she's like, I don't think you're trusting that the reader will
understand.
I'm over explaining it, and I'm probably over explaining to myself as well with the first draft, and then it's bring back.
I think everyone who writes fiction is either an overwriter or an underwriter. And I'm definitely under, and I've always been like that, even with like my essays at school and at university. I was always like, write on the word count.
But
it doesn't, like, you know, I guess in the end it doesn't really make any difference,
because it's the editing. I think, and I sometimes, and, you know, I do occasional visits to schools, and, you know, a lot of them will ask about, you know, how do you write, and blah blah blah. And I think what I wish I had known at that age was, you know, when I wrote an essay, I would just hand it in. Whereas now, like, you would never just, like, the first draft.
Oh my god! Can you imagine?
The shame. Everyone would be like, "What?"
It's such a cool, like, transformative process. Like, that, I think, has been for me the most amazing part of kind of being published, has been watching people more talented and knowledgeable than me make my book into something really good that I'm really proud of.
Yeah.
Like, I only did half of that work in a way, you know.
Well, okay.
I did more than half. But no, I just feel really... Yeah, it's a really cool process.
And I think before you start writing, you don't realise how collaborative it is.
Yeah.
You know, that you don't realise, I think, that... And then when the notes come back, oh God, the first round of notes are always terrifying because you're like...
You almost want to believe that, like... Once you've written the book, you've written the book,
yes.
And you haven't.
And it's done,
like,
it's perfect.
Yeah.
And then they come back with, it's like when you handed an essay and it comes back and there's red pen everywhere and you're looking at these notes and I'm always like, I don't know. I don't know how I'm going to do this. I have no idea how to start. This is so overwhelming. And I sort of take to bed for a couple of days.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm like, as if, you know, like
furious,
a Victorian,
yeah.
Sort of like having a fainting spell. And then you just have to get up and you have to go and the first few days are really hard and you're met with your limitations and you're met with, I'm not good. Like, for me anyway, it's the inner critic and that voice coming up with, you're not good enough, you know, who told you that you could do this, you know, you're blah, you're a fraud, you're this. And I just have to keep working through it and sort of sitting with it. And that's actually been, not just in writing, that's actually been, I think, my life's work in general, is to hear that voice, not to run away from it, to sit with it, but say, I am choosing not to engage with you. I'm choosing not to sabotage or hurt myself or, you know, behave in ways that are harmful because of that voice. Just kind of go, okay,
it exists,
keep going, yeah, and just move on through, you know.
Yeah. So what are you reading at the moment?
What am I reading at the moment? I'm actually reading a couple, but I'm always the same. I'm always reading like a few different books,
yeah,
at the same time. So I'm reading a fiction book, I'm reading sorry, I was just going to say Normal People, but it's actually Ordinary People. You know,
by Diana Evans.
Yes,
yeah. I really want to read that.
Yes, it's quite. I mean, I don't have children, but I think that if you were married with children, it could be quite grim reading.
Yeah.
Like, I keep screenshotting bits. Sorry, and sending it to my boyfriend and being like, oh, "We're never having kids."
Yeah.
It's really depressing.
The harsh truth.
Yeah. Sorry. I'm also reading a non-fiction book, which is about Jackie Kennedy and her sister and their relationship, because, you know, Lee Radizel, am I pronouncing that correctly? You know, I'm not sure, but she died in January, so it's a book about their relationship. And then I always have a self-help book on the go as well, and that one is called The Big Leap, and it's about how we sort of have these ideas about how much we can achieve, and sometimes when we go beyond that, we start to feel really uncomfortable and self-sabotage in order to sort of bring ourselves back to a level that we think is comfortable, and it's trying to kind of push past your threshold of what you think you can achieve. So yes, I always have three
fiction, non-fiction, self-help.
Yeah.
What is like your fave self-help book? What would you recommend?
Oh God, I absolutely love self-help, which is such a nerdy thing to say. I'm trying to think which has been the most useful, because I read them constantly. Like, I always have one, because I like to read it like for the last 15 minutes before I go to bed, and when I wake up, that's what I would read the first thing in the morning. Probably, I suppose, like, a really good introductory one I always think is Louise L. Hay, You Can Heal Your Life, because it is just, I think, about love and self-acceptance. And some of it, it's funny, now looking back, I'm like, I'm not 100% sure if I agree completely with all of this, but I think that's the joy of the New Age movement and New Age spirituality, which I'm really into, is that it's not dogmatic. I suppose when you're brought up in like a religion like Catholicism, and it's like, you know, I believe in the one church, and you're rejecting all others. And I think as an adult, I'm like, no, I trust my own instincts and my internal sort of, I suppose, navigation system enough at this point to realize that I know instinctively if something sits right with me and if it resonates with me, which Oprah would call an aha moment. I love Oprah. Sorry, I'm really exposing myself here. But yes, I think that I know that I can take elements of this person's philosophy and I can take elements of this person's philosophy, and I don't have to, I suppose, adhere to any one thing, because I think there's this problem at the moment where people are very much like, this is the only way. And you hear it with diets, you know, people are like, oh, you have to be a vegan, or you have to eat paleo, or you have to do lifts, or lift weights, or you have to do yoga, and this is the only one. I'm like, no, actually, everybody's body is different. Everybody's, I think, what they're drawn to is different.
And what you enjoy and what you're looking for.
Absolutely.
And maybe that's the good thing about self-help, is like, if you read that many, you've probably taken a little bit,
yes,
from all of
them. Yes, and some little bits are helpful, and
yeah.
I think it's kind of... I suppose as I get older, and I think with mental health in particular, I've begun to realise that it's not just one thing, that there's loads of different things that I do. Like, I do transcendental meditation and I take CBD oil and I go to the gym, and I like to spend, you know, an hour outside every day without my phone, and that it's actually a cumulative effect. It's not one of those things
that will just cure everything.
Yeah, absolutely. That it's a little bit of everything that kind of, I think, helps make me feel just more solid and more grounded.
Well, that's an excellent answer. Do you have any last words before we finish?
I'm trying to think. Oh my God, you put me on the spot.
Is it by The Surface Breaks by Louise O'Neill, published by Scholastic?
Yes, and this is with the paperback. There is a new chapter, which is told from the perspective of the sea witch, which was really fun to write, which Bethany very kindly read for me before we went to publication, in case I said anything really stupid or offensive.
Which you did not. It was a delight.
Thank you.
And it's a really cool inclusion in the paperback, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, that's
worth its cover price alone.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. This is great.
So you're not really on the internet anymore, so I can't tell people to follow you.
No, I'm not. And it's funny, I was talking to someone about this yesterday, and I was saying I would love to go back on to I'd love to go back onto Instagram, but Twitter, I don't know.
R.I.P. Dead to you.
I just, even the thought of it sort of makes my chest tighten a little bit.
It's a wild place.
Yeah.
It's like living under the sea.
I'm not sure if I may. You know, I'm probably too sensitive. And I think that, you know, some people who just are tougher skinned, or, you know, maybe they don't absorb it as easily as I do, I think that I probably was a little bit too sensitive.
You're not cut out for the Twitter life, and I think that's a good thing. So don't follow Louise online.
Just buy the
just
book.
Buy this book, buy all her other books. They're all excellent. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Bethany.
See you next time.